it can be the Wild West, depending where you are. And again, different countries, different jurisdictions are better and worse at it. But yeah, it's about making sure that you've got all your ducks in a row. You're maintaining what you need to do on your licenses and looking after the local communities. And all of those things are part and parcel of it. It's very different to most businesses in that respect.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your SMB spend without buying an ERP, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Philip Knowles from Apini Consulting, and we're going to dive into, pardon the pun, or mine into rather, the world, wonderful world of junior mining. This is something I had a bit of experience in back in the day, but I'm largely ignorant. So I'm hoping to get a primer from Philip today. And we're going to talk about how this industry works and, surprisingly, how fractional CFO services really are a key part of that. So, Philip, you're very welcome to the show. Maybe you can kick us off by telling us something about you that not many people know.
Yeah, thanks, James. Thanks for having me. Yeah, outside of mining and finance, I'm a qualified cricket coach these days. And I don't claim to be much good at cricket, but I do help my son and his team with their coaching and managing their cricket team. So yeah, it's my fun fact about me.
Very good. Yeah, these short ones drag us into all these sports we'd have normally no connection with whatsoever. And then, like, I met so many over here. We have Gaelic games, which is, yeah, I guess cricket without the T, let's call it. I don't know, more violent version of cricket maybe. And I meet people from the States and South Africa, and then they tell me they're a Gaelic games coach, and I was like, really? And so yeah, I have a kid, and it doesn't matter. So it works the same over here. So Apini Consulting, interesting name. Maybe you could tell us about the name to kick things off with.
Yeah, so Apini's the, I'm not much good on my Latin, but it's the Latin for the humble honeybee. And it's a slight loose connection, but I'm a big believer in the finance side of things is often that missing piece of a business, that if you don't have that, you can do all the good things. You can have the, you know, you can have the seed of the idea and all the resources poured into it, but you don't have that thing that's actually going to produce what you really need at the end of it long term. And that's where we come in as finance professionals.
Very good. That's very poetic. I love it.
Yeah, I try.
So let's kick things off by establishing your credibility. Why should we believe anything you have to say? Tell us a bit about how you got qualified.
Yeah, so I am a qualified accountant, qualified back in 2003. And I've since then worked throughout the finance industry, right from the early stages of trainee accountant through to the last of 13 years as CFO across a variety of industries. So yeah, I've been doing this a while and done a lot of things during that almost 20, well, over 20 years now in the industry.
Very good. And in the pre-interview, we talked about lots of the resource, you know, the experience you have, and you work as a fractional CFO now. But I asked you, you know, who your favorite client was. Horrible thing to say, but like, you don't have a favorite child, right? But let's face it, we all do.
I'm not telling you which one it is.
Yeah. And you came out, you meant, well, it's this junior mining client, which is interesting. And it got us off down a bit of a rabbit hole. So let's set the scene. What is junior mining? You know, when I hear of mining, I think of massive behemoth companies floated on big stock exchanges. But orientate us. What is a junior mining and how does it work?
Yeah, so the junior mining is really the lifeblood of the mining industry. So you're right. When we think about mining, we think of these massive holes in the ground and the likes of BHP and Rio and Vale and all of those, you know, producing all these resources. But those companies don't tend to do the high risk work, which is the finding the, you know, those minerals in the ground and working out which ones are viable, because you can have gold or copper or iron in the ground, but if you don't have enough of it, or it's too difficult to get to, or it's too much overburden, or whatever the reasons, it's not necessarily economically viable. So that's what falls on the junior industry to do, which is to go out there, you know, initially the picks and shovels, you know, the geologists out in the wild looking for traces of whatever they're looking for. And the junior industry then takes those through the various stages of exploration, evaluation, and development until it gets to a point where it's, you know, worth the big boys coming in and buying them out and taking them on. And sometimes, you know, the junior industry, those junior companies transition into miners themselves, depending on the resource they've got and the assets and what they want to do with it. But it's really down to us in the junior industry to go hunting for those things and doing the high risk stuff.
In tech land, I'm familiar with startups who are coming up with business ideas. Most of them hit the wall after a couple of months or a couple of years. And you also have, in the mining industry, you have a lot of speculative work, a lot of mines that never become anything, right? And I spent a period of time in Mendoza, in Argentina, and Chile, met a couple of these characters, geologists, kind of like geography teachers on steroids, if you like, who love wandering around the mountains, and they would come back every now and again. But these guys got paid huge money for wandering around the mountains and trying to basically guess. So let's explain how this works. Your experience is in Africa. So the government owns all the land, I guess. Is that how it works in Africa? And then you get a license from the government to have the right just to explore that land?
Essentially, yeah. There's you know, different countries have different setups and, you know, who owns it. But essentially, wherever you are, yeah, you're going to pay the government for a license to explore and develop on their claims. And they're all sort of divvied up into parcels of land, typically. And yeah, you grab a bunch of licenses that you think are interesting and you go to work. Or the geologists, as you say, the geography teachers on steroids, they... And a good one of those is worth, literally, pun intended, worth their weight in gold. If they're good at finding what they're looking for, and they're typically, you know, they're focused on certain parts of the world, certain parts of Africa or wherever they are, the good ones will sniff out something useful. And then it's really about you sort of narrow down those licenses. So over time, you've got to spend money, you've got to find things, you've got to report to the government. And as you find them, you narrow those parcels down. So you give up part of your licenses and you narrow it down to the ones that are of interest and focus your attentions, your time, your money, your efforts on those.
Hmm. So my experience in this came into, I used to run mineralrightsforsale.com, which is one of the many terrible businesses that I've started. But at that stage, the idea was that we would, you know, you could almost anyone can, they had a gazette, I think, in Chile, where you could just basically go to the government, spend not a lot of money. Like, having these claims were not necessarily expensive from memory. It was a couple of $100 to get, say, the claim on the land. And then the land would have like a claim, and then the ownership could be separate. So you'd have to sort of negotiate with the owner of the land versus the person who had the claim. And then, you know, you could be in business more or less for this. It was down to marketing, right? So I have a bit of land in the northern reaches of the Andes somewhere. I would turn up at, or someone would turn up at an expo and try to persuade people that there might be gold there for some reason. Am I wrong in saying there's a lot of, it's not a shady business, but there's a lot of jazz hands going on in this business? Like, it's, you really have to know your stuff or you could get taken to the cleaners.
Yeah. You know, you've got to be very careful with what you're doing and who you're dealing with. You know, I tend to leave that side of the business to the guys with the local connections and right, know what they're doing. But yeah, you've got to watch your back. It can be the Wild West, depending where you are. And again, different countries, different jurisdictions are better and worse at it. But yeah, it's about making sure that you've got all your ducks in a row. You're maintaining what you need to do on your licenses and looking after the local communities. And all of those things are part and parcel of it. It's, you know, it's very different to most businesses in that respect.
So London is a, you know, center, in the financial center of the world, as I understand it, maybe Canada as well, you can tell me. So people show up from wherever their mining claim is. I'm just going to say it could be west of Ireland, or it could be, you know, Lesotho in South Africa. And they arrive up, they could be a geography teacher on steroids, they could be a geologist. They come to you and they say, hey, I think I have some land, I want to start raising. Yeah, or do they start raising money directly, or how does this work?
Yeah, a lot of companies will start a private company. They'll raise a bit of money through their contacts. They may have some money themselves if they've been successful previously with assets. And they'll start getting to a point where they think they can bring out outside investors in, essentially. If you think you can start getting either institutionals or, you know, private family money in or what have you at scale, you need to get to that stage. So it's about doing the initial groundwork on the cheap. So a lot of these, you know, will, as you say, there'll be a license fee to pay, not necessarily particularly big. Mm-hmm. You'll get some local geologists, which are not particularly expensive. You'll do your sort of rock sampling and stream sampling and whatever else you need to do to identify an asset And then it's really about the next stages, which is where typically they'll start looking a bit further afield, because you'll start getting into the hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of funding needed to go to the next stages. And that's when they'll typically come to London, initially probably as private. And then when they've got something that they think the public might be interested in, they'll often look to list on AIM or, you know, in Canada on TSXV or one of the other exchanges.
Okay, so for, let's say, 100 grand, I can get as far as having a piece of land, commissioning a few geologists. I turn up in London. Let's talk about the exchange. It's quite strange to go from, you know, a non-business basically straight to a listed business. So how come I can't do this as a tech business and yet these guys are able to do it, you know, in their industry?
Yeah, the rules around the mining industry are slightly different. And I wouldn't want to go into all the details. I wouldn't know all the details myself. But typically a junior miner with some sort of track record, you're not going in there just with a raw license and hoping for the best. You'll have to have something. You'll have to have competent persons reports that say what you've got from an independent expert will verify, yeah, you've got this, you're saying you've got this, and you know, I concur. So there'll be a lot of paperwork to produce, from financials through to technical reports, geology, all of that sort of stuff will come together. So while you don't have a trading history per se, because you've not produced anything, you will have assets that are verifiable. And that's how the AIM market works from that perspective.
Okay, so the AIM market is, what is it, alternative investment? What's the TLA?
Alternative Investments Market.
So if you have your reports, this market is set up for this sort of thing. It knows how to read these reports. I guess there's a screening phase where you work with a geologist, you put together some sort of pack that goes into the AIM. They have people who know what they're talking about. If it looks legit, then they'll say, okay, you're able to go to the next stage. And then at that stage, is there marketing involved? Are you still pressing the fresh, or is it just you blip up on a computer screen somewhere and people start, you know, transferring funds?
So when you list, you have to raise money essentially. And you wouldn't want to list and not raise money anyway. The whole purpose of the listing really is to go out there and raise funds.
Yeah.
So part and parcel of that listing exercise, and you know, it could be a direct listing, it could be a reverse. So there's cash shells on AIM and businesses reversing. That's what Rome Resources have done, which is one of my clients very recently. And at the same time, you go and raise funds for the next stages of exploration or evaluation or development or wherever you are at that stage. So there'll be a big marketing piece alongside it. And this is where often it gets quite complicated. And this is where sometimes it's quite slow to list, because you've got to get the listing bit and the fundraising bit together. And with markets being how they are, especially at the high risk, which is the junior mining side of things, the two don't always match up. You can do all the work on the listing and then find the market's not really open for the money that you need to raise, and you have to park things and revisit it and go again, you know, a few months later. So it can be a long-winded process for sure.
Okay, what I heard there was getting your claim together, maybe in the order of 100 grand, but then actually it's probably 5 or 10 times that just to get list the paperwork involved in getting listed is the bulk of where the money goes in terms of investment.
Yeah. It's not cheap. There's a lot of consultants and lawyers and accountants and everything involved in that. And I always say to people that, you know, the most cost effective and cheapest part of the process is me. You know, the fees that the lawyers and the accountants, the external accountants are charging far outweigh what I'm doing. But, you know, on that, I think if, you know, when you are listing, sometimes companies wait till you're listed to bring in a CFO, because that's the point they legally need one. They've got these responsibilities under AIM. But really the value starts to be added long before that in teeing everything up and getting your ducks in a row, making sure that you've got all the information you need for that process. And it's easy to replicate and to refresh as and when you need it. So there's a lot of value in bringing them in at an earlier stage than maybe you think you absolutely have to have them there.
Okay. So this is where, you know, a fractional makes sense. Fractional can maybe support two or three of these projects at a time. It's obviously a cost advantage. And then you can dedicate more of your money, I guess, into the marketing and getting onto the exchange in the first place. Now, all of this is just breaking ground. Like there's nothing being extracted from that. This is just to get to the stage of putting your first drill on site. All anyone has is a map and a thesis at this stage. And at the end of the day, you can't, as I understand it, there's still no way to know whether what's in there until you start digging stuff out of the ground. Like, there's no technology that can help you there.
It depends on the asset that you're
okay.
you're looking to develop, that the mineral that you're looking to develop, as to what you've got to do, whether it's, you know, drilling or whether it's bulk sampling or whatever other techniques there are. There's all sorts of different things that marry up to paint the picture. And what you're looking to do is to define a resource with enough confidence that people will give you money or invest right. money into your business to go and, you know, exploit that asset, to go and build a mine and to pull it out. So, and this is where it gets very technical, and this is where the geologists and the engineers come in. But essentially, you're looking to get enough confidence by drilling enough holes or taking enough samples, getting those assayed independently at independent labs to say, this is the grade you've got, this is the size of resource you've got, this is what a mine would look like if you look to develop it, this is what it would cost to build that. And all of that paints the picture. And that's then I step back in with DCFs, you know, net present value models, looking to work out what value that has right. and how much you need to raise to do that, and how all of that looks in financial terms. Because that's what the investors are really looking at. You know, they'll say they're interested in the geology, but a lot of the time it'll go straight over their heads. Really, they want to know, what have I got? You know, how much money am I going to make out of this?
So, yeah, it sounds crazy at this stage because no one has dug anything out of the ground. So it's a scientific wild-ass guess at this time. And everyone kind of knows that, I guess. They realize, okay, we've got some financials here, but your assumptions that go into that model got to be so broad that you got to be, okay, it's more or less to show that you have your professional ducks in a row. Everyone understand it's still like a one. What are these shots? Are these 1 in 100 shots? Are they 1 in 10 shots? Is there a...
It depends what stage you are. I mean, if you're just sort of scraping holes in the ground at a very early stage, it's, you know, it's, yeah, it's 1 in 100 or probably even rarer. Once you get to the point where the further down the line you go, the more work you do, the more you invest in it and the more results you get out of it, obviously the better those odds become, because you don't go throwing good money or shouldn't go throwing good money after bad. You've got to do that work to get to the stage where you're confident. And you're right, there's obviously a big element of guesswork, if you like, but that guesswork becomes less and less the more you do. And this is why the industry has, you know, in most cases, something like JORC compliant resource, which is where there's an independent set of regulations to say you've got to have certain, you know, effectively number of holes, right. sizes of samples. All of that gets you different levels of certainty, you know, in inferred, indicated, measured resources. And the further up that chain you go, the more likely it is you've got what you think you've got. And therefore, you can hang your hat on what those numbers say in a cash flow or valuation model.
So let's talk a bit about who's funding this stuff. So clearly you need to have a lot of bets placed, because in my world, the startup world, it's like, sounds like a VC, the equivalent of a VC is like, you know, very few of them are going to succeed. Are these institutional investors? There must be, because you must need a big war chest to be able to have the scale necessary to make this work.
Yeah, a lot of times it'll be the institutions. You'll have, certainly in the early stages, you'll often have high net worth individuals in there. You'll have some of the smaller institutions. You'll have some of the private brokers. You'll have, you know, people putting their own money directly in as well, which is, you know, the beauty of the AIM market. But it's high risk. It's high risk and high reward. So diversified portfolios are never more important than in the junior mining industry. And you know, I'd like to think the individuals recognize that, but certainly the institutional investors do. So they'll spread their risk across a number of asset classes and businesses within those.
Yeah, it's interesting world in that from an entrepreneur's perspective, like, the, you know, you could really go big or go home. Like, it's actually not that hard to get into if you really put your mind to it. You have to hire a few people, you have to do some paperwork. But then it's a 1 in 100 shot, or even worse. You have to wonder how many of those rolls of dice you can afford to do before you hit, right?
Yeah, and you'll have some that sort of come and go relatively quickly. You'll have others that pivot, I guess, to sort of put it into right. you know, tech type terms. There'll be businesses that pivot. They'll go down one route. They'll typically be very good at doing it in a cost effective way. And as soon as they realize that's not the right one. For whatever reason, they'll pivot quickly to something else. So there are businesses, you know, there's companies out there that haven't produced a mine in sort of 10, 20 years sometimes, but they're going through and they're sort of narrowing down what they're doing. You'll have others go in a lot quicker and a lot faster, and others still that have got, you know, a really good asset, and it's about educating the market as to how good it is, because you can only go as fast as the money allows you to go. So that, you know, the more you can raise, the more you can do, but you've got to time the market, and the resources have got to be in the right space, the market's got to be in the right space. So these things can take a long time to develop.
So depending on the DCF, then the scale gets out of control quickly. So is this something where I can basically, if I get as far as listing, can I sell my interest then at that stage? Is that the exit for a lot of junior miners, or how common would be it for them to try and develop that mine themselves?
The listing is not typically the exit. That's normally the start point, or the sort of kickoff point. So that's when you can raise the money to sort of really dig, you know, dig into that resource. The exit point for a lot of juniors comes when they get a resource that is, you know, a JORC compliant resource that is of a certain quality, where the DCF and the NPV says this is worth investing in. That's typically where the bigger boys will come in that have got the ability to mine. They've got the assets, they've got the resources and the knowledge and capabilities, and importantly, often have the money, or at least the contacts and the ability to raise that money at the volumes you need to go in and mine. Because that stage, you suddenly go from a business that's raising 2, 3, 4, 5 million a year to do your development work to suddenly needing 50, 100 million to build the mine. It's a very different place to be as a junior. Yeah. So often juniors don't do that themselves. It'll end up going to someone else, or they may JV or farm it out to someone who'll do all the work for them. They'll retain an interest in it. So there's different ways of doing it, and a lot depends on the asset class and the market and who's around and who needs to beef up their resources to maintain their value moving forward.
And it's a weird and wonderful world. I remember talking to a taxi driver from the north of Chile with a heavy Chilean accent, trying to explain to me with my broken Spanish how great his find was. But literally, you have some of these mines are literally family businesses. They scale all the way down from literally a hole in the ground in someone's garden, more or less, to all the way up to, you know, as far as you want to go. It's kind of fascinating and interesting world. What are the big mistakes you see people making as junior who come to London? Let's say they show up in London, they think they're ready to go. What are the mistakes that you see them making?
I think one of the biggest ones, it's not always easy to overcome, but one of the biggest is just not raising enough money when you've got the opportunity, because it is an expensive business and it's always more expensive than the people on the ground think. I always say the most dangerous time for a junior miner is when they just raise money. Because it's amazing how quickly that'll go out the door if you don't keep tabs on it. So you think you've raised a big chunk of fund, but when you know, your drilling contracts are expensive and operating in certain jurisdictions is expensive, and your fees to your advisors and listing fees are expensive, it doesn't go far enough far too often. And then that weighs on the share price because people think you're going to be raising money next week, and you know, it's a spiral. So I think that's probably the biggest issue. And then I think, and it's become less so now, because I think businesses are a bit more savvy than they were maybe to 15 years ago when I first got into the industry. But you have to keep a very tight rein on what you're spending, both in, you know, at London corporate level and also in country, for the same reasons that it goes very quickly. As CFO, the real hard work almost starts after you raise the money, because that's when you're keeping tabs on it, controlling it, monitoring it, running the cash flows on a weekly basis to make sure that nothing's going astray, trying to get the information out of, you know, the local jurisdiction, out of your accountants in the DRC or Sierra Leone or wherever it is, in a timely fashion. Just trying to keep on top of things. It's hard work, but it's essential for the business to be able to thrive and to do what it needs to do, put the money in the ground.
Yeah. Okay. So let's switch on to my favorite topic, cost control then. So, because the top line, you know, I guess what you're digging out of the ground, you don't have much control over what that's going to be worth. It goes on an exchange, it's a literal commodity. So all the opportunity really is in how much margin you're able to maintain. What are some good strategies for setting yourself up to win in that regard, to make sure you've raised the money, you're ready to start paying more geologists and equipment and stuff like this? What's your go-to move to make sure you retain control of the costs?
One of the biggest things, especially with the big ticket items, is really developing strong relationships with the people you're buying from, whether that's your drilling companies. You know, in the DRC, we have to use helicopters because we're so remote. You've got to have good relationships with these guys and do the hard work in terms of negotiating things at an early stage, because once you're in those relationships, it's almost impossible to negotiate better terms. That's the same with any business, isn't it? It's not, you know, unique to the mining industry, but in the mining industry, we're often talking big numbers. You're often talking about businesses that are in different jurisdictions. You know, we'll get a lot of our mining equipment from South Africa, for example. That's where most things come from in Africa. But we're based up in London. So it's about building those relationships and then maintaining those, both at a local level and at a, you know, and at a corporate level, and keeping track of everything.
So I'm smiling because I'm reading Strong Female Character at the moment by Fern Brady, a Scottish comedian, and she's autistic, and she explains, you know, how people would want to build relationships with her and go for a coffee or whatever. And she, as an autistic person, she said, "Oh yeah, I learned later that building relationships is pretending to be friends so that I can get what I want from you," which I thought was a funny way of looking at it, but. Yeah, maybe not that far from the truth. So when you say that, like, is it worth actually, you get on a plane, go down and have a braai with them in South Africa? Or what do you what does that mean when you say build relationships?
100%. I mean, it depends on, you know, the scale of the contract and what you're doing. But it's, you know, I've done that in the past. You know, typically in South Africa, there's the big Indaba mining conference in February, which is lovely if you get the chance to get down there. It's a great event, and everyone congregates down there. And having those face-to-faces with people that are, you know, 10, 12 hours away on a flight normally is important if you get that opportunity. So certainly when you get to the stage of building a mine, that's when the numbers are really big, and having those face-to-face relationships become absolutely vital, I think. And having, you know, good partners in the industry as well, from a, you know, a procurement point of view, from sort of sourcing what you're doing and making sure you can get those goods into country and transporting and all of that side of things. Having good partners is important, because it's a difficult industry to be in, and those relationships become more important, you know, times when you're raising money and you're sort of negotiating with them credit terms and all of that sort of stuff. So yeah, I think it's just, you know, having really good relationships and a strong network.
So from a, let's talk about a little bit of technology perspective here. We have a couple of mining customers, and the challenge is that business is an awkward Goldilocks zone. You know, they don't have the resources for a massive, let's say, ERP rollout, I presume, or it's not appropriate. You know, they might be working still from Sage or some other technology. So from a very tactical perspective, how do you go to managing, you know, things like, you know, only paying for what you've actually received? You don't know what's showing up in DRC in a field in the middle of nowhere. How do you keep all that synced?
I think a lot of times it's about going back to basics. It's about not getting too far ahead of yourselves. If you try putting a relatively sophisticated ERP system in, or, you know, purchase order control system into the DRC, for example, it's not going to get used. It just won't happen. So I tend to go back to basics, certainly where, you know, pre-building a mine stage, and just put the systems and processes in that people can use. So typically it'll be Excel based a lot of the time, certainly in this scale, but it's about having the Excel tools that people can use, and, you know, they're foolproof. They can't get wrong. There's checks and balances in there. Well, they can get wrong, and they often do, but there's checks and balances in there so you know that they've got it wrong and you can easily fix it. When I first started in Sierra Leone 10 and 15, 12 years ago, the guys there in country were using cash books in Excel, but they weren't adding the column up at the bottom. They were going into a calculator and they were adding the column up at the bottom, and they were color coding everything in 50 different colors, and it never added up and never made sense. But it was as simple as going in and giving them a protected spreadsheet with all the bits in and drop downs and stuff, which didn't take long to set up. but then they could use it. And all of a sudden, rather than spending hours and hours and hours every month trying to decipher, you know, where the heck the money had gone, it was there, it was done. So for me, certainly in this industry, it's about going back to basics first before you try and do anything more sophisticated than that.
That's my favorite bugbear with Excel sheets. My business partner loves coding things by color. So I'm like, Rich, tell me again, what does mauve mean? And then how's that different to off pink, you know? And you're like trying to, it's impossible to keep it together. Okay, very good. Listen, this has been fascinating. Really enjoyed dipping back into this world. So if people want to get in touch with you and maybe talk a bit more, maybe they are in the mining industry, maybe they want to find out more about how you can help them when they pitch up from the middle of nowhere in London and wonder what to do next, how can they get in touch?
Yeah, so you can find me on LinkedIn, as everyone is these days, Philip Knowles or Apini Consulting, or drop me an email on philip.k@apini.co.uk. And yeah, we'd be delighted to try and help.
Great. Thanks, Philip. And thank you very much for listening to the Gross Profit Podcast. If you've got this far into the podcast, your special reward, I think what gift should I give them, Philip, today? I think I'll give them the gift of being able to register for an account on procurementexpress.com, especially if you're in an extraction industry like that. You're looking for something to help make sure that you're controlling those costs on the ground. We have people using our software every day in fields in the middle of nowhere in South Africa and Australia and Africa, all around the place. And our mobile apps are particularly suited to help doing things like receiving items on the ground in a way that you can bank on with photographic evidence if necessary. So I think that's a good call to action. And I'll leave you with that gift, dear listener. Philip, you've been a star. Thanks very much for being on the show.
Pleasure. Thank you, James.